for that reminder. So this is our Historical Society presentation for December 14th, 2020. We welcome Jerry Wiles to our virtual stage. And Jerry, take it away.
I will. Thank you. Thank you for having me in your home tonight on a very historic day in our nation's history. And so it is an honor to be sharing these moments with you. We're going to go back 79 years ago today, the 14th of December. On that day, out somewhere in the North Atlantic, aboard a vessel called the Prince of Wales was the Prime Minister of England, Winston Churchill. He had set sail the day before, and he was coming to America to visit his friend, Franklin Roosevelt. They had been pen pals, had only met one time formally before, and so he was coming over to see him. As he said, meet eye to eye, conversations with each other in an intimate way. Because what was at stake at this time was the future of the free world. And he felt correspondence has gone far enough, let's go see each other. You see, a week before, Pearl Harbor had happened. And within that week's span, we had gone to war with Japan, gone to war with Germany, and gone to war with Italy. This was not Winston Churchill's first voyage over here. He had been to this country when he was 21 years old. His mother, you know, was born in New York City, in Brooklyn. And he came over to see where his mother's family was from when he was 21 years old. And then at the turn of the century, he was trying to sell a book to the United States called The Boer War. He came over here to promote his book. He didn't do very well, but he did meet Theodore Roosevelt and other luminaries. And then in the 1930s, he paid another visit. And in 1931, in the summer of 1931, he was hit by an automobile and almost died in the New York hospital. Thank God they saved his life. So this wasn't the first visit to our shores. Remember, Winston Churchill was born in English aristocracy in 1874 on January 30th, ironically the same day that Franklin Roosevelt will be born 8 years later. He grew up in splendor. He went to a private school, didn't do well, went to Sandhurst Military Academy, excelled there, was going to make a career in the military part of the British culture, got involved with the military, got involved with Parliament, got involved with the Conservative Party, became a politician. And in World War I, he was the first Lord of the Admiralty. Didn't do well there because of a botched invasion of Gallipoli, was demoted to as Minister of Munitions. But his whole career was either serving politically or in the Ministry of Great Britain. And in May of 1940, when the war was going so horribly for the Great Britain, when they looked like they were at the end of everything, he was promoted to be Prime Minister. And he had been in this position for 20 months. And through his voice, through his charisma, and persuasive talking, he had managed to keep the British people going throughout this ordeal. As he said when he heard the report that America was now at war because of Pearl Harbor, he turned to his wife, Clementine. He said, finally, I can get a night's rest. Well, let's turn the pages back a little bit and get to the genesis of this thing. Let's go back to World War I from 1914 to 1918. Let's go back to when America was led by Woodrow Wilson, and he simply told people when the foreign war broke out in France with the Germans and the Russians and the Italians that America would not go to that war. And he kept his promise for well over 2 years. It's not our business. And we did not go. And then finally, with a number of things taking place on the high seas when we were trying to trade with the belligerents, in April of 1917, we went to war. A war, as Wilson said, to save the world for democracy. We would be a better world because of this war. And forward, off we went, over there. Americans entered late, but that didn't matter. It was very costly. We lost in the great battles of France 127,000 lives. When the war was drawn to an end in November of 1918, they said after the armistice, we must form a peace that will guarantee there will never be another war, a peace that will guarantee that Americans will never leave its shore again to fight on somebody else's land. And so they agreed to meet in France, in Paris, and the great luminaries of the time, Woodrow Wilson, the premier of Lord Clemenceau, Lord George, they met in Paris to formulate a peace treaty. Winston Churchill, in one of his great quotes, was, "There's no such thing as a bad peace and a good war." Well, guess what? He was mistaken on this one. It was a bad peace treaty. We didn't even sign it. The Senate refused to ratify it. And the essence of it was, it would just lead to more wars. Because instead of going for peace, we punished. We punished Germany. We ripped them apart financially, globally, occupied their territory. And so it was as we ended the war going into the 1920s, enduring the great Spanish flu, influenza, and so forth. We made up our minds in this country, let's stay within ourselves. Let's isolate. Let's not look overseas to do anything. America first. And so we string it out through the 1920s. We prohibit people from drinking. That will make us better. We decide to do outlandish things in sports and entertainment and so forth. It's very entertaining. We call it the Roaring Twenties. We have three presidents, one by the name of Hardin. He dies in office. The other one is Coolidge. Some people thought he had died, but he stayed on. And then there was Hoover. Well, at the latter part of Hoover's administration in 1929, he woke up one day in November and said, "Oh my God, the stock market has collapsed. We're facing a horrible time economically." And so began the so-called Great Depression. We're not at war with anybody, but internally, our country is falling apart. We cried out as a nation, we need help. Hoover tried the best he could, but it didn't work. But up in Albany, New York, there sat the governor of New York. His name was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he told his wife, Eleanor, "I'm going to throw my hat in the ring. I'm going to run for the presidency of the United States, Eleanor." Believe it or not, she did not like it. She preferred to be the First Lady of New York rather than the First Lady of our country. But he ran, and what was striking about him running? He was crippled. He had suffered from polio that he had contracted in 1921. It looked as if in 1921, in the 1920s, that he was doomed, that he would never be a politician again, that he was out. Instead, heroically, he made a comeback, realized his weaknesses and realized his strengths, ran and got elected. And so there he is. You go back with Franklin Roosevelt quickly and you look at his life. Born in 1882, grew up in Hudson Valley, aristocracy, the upper Roosevelts. The lower Roosevelts, of course, were down in Oyster Bay, the Teddy Roosevelt people, and went off to school, lost his father at an early age, went off to private school, did very well because he had somebody leading him. Somebody leading him by the hand, his mother, Sarah Roosevelt. She protected him, pushed him on his way. He graduated from the prep school and went on to Harvard. While at Harvard, coming home one day, he ran into his cousin, Eleanor Roosevelt. The Roosevelts met the Roosevelts. And lo and behold, they struck up a conversation. They struck up agreement to meet each other. And much to the chagrin of Sarah Roosevelt, they agreed to be married. Eleanor had lost her father at a young age, lost a mother also, gone off to private school in England, come back to be a social worker. She thought she knew what she was going to do, and then she ran into Franklin. They were married in 1905, and within 12 years, they were four boys and one girl. Franklin rises up in the political world of New York and becomes the Assistant Secretary of the United States Navy under Wilson. And so it is. This couple had come together, had a family, and on their way. And then, gosh darn it, in 1921, Franklin came down with polio. But as I said, it didn't stop him. So the 30s come in. What's our country doing? We're looking inward. Take care of ourselves. Solve this depression. But overseas, if you woke up and looked at it closely and read your newspapers and listened to the communiques, the world safe for democracy was not that. It was a world safe for dictatorship. Stalin had taken over in the Soviet Union, had formed a horrible regime, ruining his people's lives, demanding more from them than what they could get. In Italy, Mussolini had taken over in the 1920s and was running a fascist state, a government unto him and nobody else. And then slowly, out of the ashes of Germany, rose up this corporal who became overnight the chancellor and president of Germany in 1933, Adolf Hitler. What went wrong? We're not supposed to have any more problems. Well, there it was glaring at us. That's their problems, not our problem. Well, if you look across the other way to the Pacific, same thing was happened with the Japanese society. The military establishment was taken over. And lo and behold, in 1931, they invaded Manchuria. And in 1936, they invaded China. Went in unimpeded, raped China. It's not us, it's them. And then in Ethiopia, Mussolini invades. United Nations, what United Nations? Well, by 1938 and 39, things were starting to look very bleak. Hitler was getting away with annexation of Austria, Sudetenland. He was getting away with anything he wanted to do. And in 1938, in August, the handwriting was on the wall. The handwriting was very clear. Soviet Union has agreed to a non-aggression pact. Hitler, I won't attack you if you don't attack me, Joe Stalin. Signed and delivered. Green light. The green light, September 1st, 1939. Germany invaded Poland. A war that was supposed to end the wars 20 years ago, now comes another one. Not us. England, yes, because of treaty obligations. France, yes, because of treaty obligations. But America will sit back and watch and maybe make some money off this war also. Who knows? But it's not our concern. 39, it looks as if fleetingly that the war might end in Europe because it was called a Sit War, the Sitzkrieg. But then it flared up in the spring of 1940. It went with a roar and these countries toppled. from Norway down into France and Belgium and so forth, down into Yugoslavia, Greece. And the Nazi regime was running over those countries. What are you going to do, United States? Nothing. We support England, we support France. Morally, they're doing the right thing, but we can't do anything. So 1940 rolls along, and we have here at our stateside, we have a guy by the name of Charles Lindbergh, who the great aviator has now taken hold of the anti-war establishment. And he has come out with America First, and we shall not go to war. If we go to war, it will be because we are puppets of the Jewish people. And now it starts to become quite angry as we turn into 1941. And in 1941, on January 6, we have a whole new thing in our society. Something had happened. In November of 1940, my God, Roosevelt ran for the third term, and he got elected. Unprecedented. What does that mean in January? What does it mean? It means something's up with this country, that we don't trust a new president during this time of chaos. And he issues his 4 points of freedom. We should be free from want, from fear, from the suppression of religion, and the suppression of speech. What does that mean, Mr. Roosevelt? What is the message you're sending to the American people? He's told the American people more than once, American boys will never fight in a foreign war. And so we move along through 41, and things are getting edgy. And then in June of 1941, the Soviet Union is invaded by the German Wehrmacht, the largest invasion in the history of the world. And so now the fight is on, and now we're going to have to, we've been supporting Great Britain with lend-lease, with supplies and munitions, not at war, but at least supporting them. Now we have to do the same thing with the Soviet Union. But we're not there. But we do go on the high seas where they have submarines like in World War I. And then a message goes out to Mr. Roosevelt, would you meet me off the coast of Newfoundland? I would like to have a chat with you. Winston Churchill, your friend. So in the middle of August 1941, they meet off the coast of Newfoundland to arrange the Atlantic Charter, a mutual agreement that in any way the United States, short of war, can help Great Britain at will, and make sure that we clear ourselves for post-war settlements. There is a wonderful film clip on this. If you could ever watch it, it is the two of them sitting together on the boat singing Onward Christian Soldiers, marching off to war. Well, in September of that year, in October, we decided we've got some problems coming in. Okay. In September of that year, we decide
call from Jordan Phillips
to put an embargo.
Call from Sorry, Jordan Phillips.
Hi. Okay. I hope I'm on.
Yeah, no.
All right.
I think you're fine. Just be louder.
Oh boy, zoom, zoom. All right, yeah, let's speak louder. Okay. So we place an embargo on Japan. No more raw iron, no more oil. Japan, you see, is seething. Their society and their culture and history believes that they have the space over in the South Pacific that's theirs, not the foreign entities that are there. Not the Europeans, not the Americans. And therefore, they have the right to go into any place and seize what they can. It's in their own backyard. We're suspicious of this. In Washington, D.C., we know that there's a large Japanese fleet out there someplace. But the general consensus is it is heading for the Philippines. It's probably going down into maybe into British New Guinea or Dutch New Guinea. It may be going over into around Indochina, but it's not certainly And then 2:30, Sunday afternoon, December 7th, 1941. The Giants-Dodgers football game was interrupted. The New York Philharmonic Orchestra was interrupted. Flash news bulletin, Pearl Harbor, our naval base, is being bombed by the Japanese. When Roosevelt received the news at 1:30, his aide, Harry Hopkins, said, "I don't think this is right, sir. I think this is misinformation coming in. Certainly the fleet didn't go over to Pearl Harbor and attacked us." And Roosevelt turned to him in a very stern way and said, "Oh yes, they would do that." Well, now the news came in that day, slowly, and then it was elevated, and then they realized what a horrible thing had taken place. The Navy trapped, sitting ducks. The Army, the Air Corps trapped, sitting ducks. Over 2,000 lives lost, and nothing that we could do. He called in Eleanor. He hadn't told her yet. She took one look at him and said, "Franklin, what's wrong?" And he told her. He said, "Now, Eleanor, what I must do, I must have time by myself to think." He was at his best when everybody else was at their worst. He could pull inward and think. "But I'm going to ask you to do me a favor. I'm going to ask you to go on the radio tonight at 6:30 and talk to the American people. Will you please put together a talk for them? Because I must go to work and formulate a speech before Congress tomorrow asking for war." What a partnership. She agreed to do this, and it is one of the most memorable moments of history with the First Lady or anybody. She gave her announcement on NBC. She was used to the microphone. She was given daily conferences many times. And she spoke to the American people, told them as best as what had happened, recollected for them what had gone on through the day in Washington, D.C. And then she said, so clearly, "I want to speak directly to the mothers of America. I, along with you mothers, have 4 sons that are in the military. I am worried also, but I can tell you they'll all be well taken care of, and I can tell you that America will stand behind them. And you can rest assured on that." She had won the hearts of the American people on that night. And so now the chains to take over after the 7th and the 8th of when Roosevelt went before Congress and gave his famous Day of Infamy speech and the declaration of war as he asked for. What do you do in your home capital that's far removed from the West Coast? Well, the first thing you try to institute is a blackout, because you know very well that the Germans are going to be close by, perhaps with their U-boats. And within a matter of days, Germany and Italy have declared war on us. So you put these things together, which is kind of interesting. In the White House, they decided to put some barricades out front. No more fires in the fireplace, because that smoke could alert somebody. They told Franklin Roosevelt, no longer eating at your favorite restaurants. You have to stay at home and eat. And that was one of the worst things you could have told him, because he hated the menu at the White House. He detested the chef who served god-awful meals, Henrietta Nesbitt, which is a story unto itself. But he's going to have to make sacrifices like everybody else. And then over at the Treasury Department, they set up an escape system for the president. If there happened to be an invasion of Washington and a bombing of Washington, he would be wheeled in a wheelchair in the underground walkways to the Treasury building. And they put a person in a wheelchair and they timed it how long it would take for him to get over there. It was 1 minute. And so they were content that that would be enough to save him from being bombed. Mrs. Roosevelt said, I can't stay in Washington. I've got to go with my daughter, Anna, out on the West Coast. And I got to visit the people of the West Coast. They need to see me and they need to hear me that I'm with them. And if they're threatened, I want to be right there with them. And so she boarded an airplane and she was heading for the West Coast. Halfway out, radio silence was broken. The announcement was, San Francisco is being bombed. They told the First Lady, who was planning on heading for Los Angeles, and she simply said, take me to San Francisco, I want to see for myself. Within a half hour, it was called off. There was no such thing, it was a false report. Yes, she went to California and will spend 6 days out on the West Coast. What she sees are things that she doesn't like. She sees Japanese American citizens being rounded up. She sees them threatening. She sees them fearing for their lives. There were many Chinese out there, and the Chinese were so afraid they'd be identified as Japanese that they wore signs, I'm Chinese. And so our government and the government of California decided, maybe for their own protection, but definitely we didn't want any saboteurs to round up the Japanese Americans and send them to concentration camps where they would be concentrated. There'd be 10 camps scattered all over the West where the Japanese, 127,000 of them all together. She protested vehemently against this. But it didn't matter. In fact, she called her husband's bluff on it. She says, you issue the four freedoms of want and fear, Franklin. Think about it. Well, when she returns, she gets a message from the president. Eleanor, we have a surprise guest or guest coming tomorrow on the 23rd. Will you prepare some rooms at the White House and tell your chef to prepare some meals because I want these people taken care of? He doesn't tell her who it is. He doesn't tell her that it's Winston Churchill and his entourage coming over. He's kind of waiting to the last minute because he doesn't want to break any secrecy. Churchill has had a rough trip. It was so rough that the escorts with the battleship, the Prince of Wales, had to turn back. Churchill seemed to survive it very well. As he says, I ate well, I drank well, I was able to get some sleep, believe it or not. I read a great book on Napoleon, and I wrote some wonderful papers. I'm ready. Well, ironically, he landed before schedule at Norfolk Station down at the mouth of the Potomac. Being impetuous as he is, being the Winston Churchill that we know, he decides, what the heck? I'm going to go to Washington, D.C. tonight. Give me a plane. I'm going to play a surprise visit. Well, here's where it gets fun. Eleanor, dear, have supper ready tonight, right off. Why, Franklin? Winston Churchill will be here at 6:15. And sure enough, there is Winston Churchill, members of his own cabinet, arriving at Washington, D.C. Gets off the plane. The president is leaning up against the car, waiting for him. Churchill has a cane with a flashlight, because in Great Britain, everything's dark over there, so you can't get around without a flashlight on your cane. And he says to Franklin Roosevelt, "I flew over your city tonight. It was lit up. It was beautiful. It represents freedom." And so now, the next moment, it is agreed before they have something to eat, they should have a drink. And so they have a drink or two and they toast each other. They said something that we have in common, commonality. And then they have dinner after having the caviar, after having smoked clams. And they said, "What's on the menu?" "Broiled chicken. Love it or leave it." Well, that didn't matter. They retire. They go back to the study of President Roosevelt. And Churchill makes it very clear what he wants right off. He says, "I do not want to sleep in any room except the Rose Room. I've heard it's a beautiful room. And I want you to take the Monroe Room and convert it into a map room. I want my map set up by tomorrow morning." Roosevelt says, "Splendid idea. Yes, yes, Mr. Wilson, yes." And he said, Mr. Churchill. He says, "No, I don't," they called each other Winston and Franklin. He says, "Not only that, I want everything set up so I can talk with your head butler. Not right now, but a little bit later." "Yes." Roosevelt turns around and tells his aides, "Go down into my room, take the woman's bathroom over and make it into a map room. I want my own map room." So the way they went. Now, they will speak for 90 minutes on that first night on the 22nd of December, 1941. The topics, I don't know what their topics were. I can tell you what I think they were, and I'll pretend I know. I guarantee you they will talk about where should the A team go first. Where should America's full arsenal go first and foremost? And believe it or not, Winston Churchill said Europe before the South Pacific. But now you must realize it was the Japanese who attacked us and the American people are looking the other way. And they talk about the South Pacific. They talk about the Japanese full bore. They will go into Hong Kong and take Hong Kong. They will go into Singapore. Singapore has 85,000 British soldiers and Australian soldiers there, and they will give up to 30,000 Japanese. This is what's going to come about in December of 1941. Malaysia falls. The Guineas fall, Dutch Guinea, British New Guinea. What about the Philippines? Mr. Roosevelt, General Douglas MacArthur is in charge of the Philippines, of the American Army, and of the Filipino army. Can he resist? And Roosevelt shows him the communiques coming from MacArthur. "We're fighting a big tank battle at Manila. We're starting to dominate. We will not retreat. We very much have the upper hand." All lies, no truth, nothing like that was happening. The Japanese were coming down through unimpeded, marching down through the great islands of the Philippines. What was basically happening was General MacArthur was going to be on a run. He was going to have to take his son and his wife and his bank account and scatter to Bataan, scatter to Corregidor for a last minute stand. What was happening in the Philippines was a complete destruction of the European and American presence there by the great Japanese imperial forces. Well, now let's turn to Europe, what's going on in Europe. Stalin is begging you, Mr. President, is begging for more aid. We're all begging for your support. We have to start a new front. We have to come in some way from the other end. Stalin needs help. He can't fight the Germans alone. The Battle of Stalingrad has just started. Leningrad, the old capital of St. Petersburg, under siege for 900 days. It's not attacked, it's just surrounded and cut off. 800,000 people died there in 900 days. 800,000. Most of them starved to death. They would drop over as they were walking on the sidewalk. They'd drop over in the midst of conversation because they were starving to death. But Old Man Winter had hit Russia. Old Man Winter was causing the German army to bog down and bringing a great deal of hardship on the German soldiers. 3,000 amputees a day for the German army because they were freezing. Hitler called out in Christmas and did something that he did not like to do. He said, I need the German people to turn over their winter gear. I need them to turn over their clothing. Send all the clothing that you have to help my soldiers from freezing to death. They thought it was going to be a short war in the summer and the fall. Well, far from that. Hitler does what he's best at. He starts firing his generals and takes over the supreme command himself. So all of these things are taking place. And the big question is, where first with the great American might? It will be Europe, much to the disappointment of those in the South Pacific. And the part that bothers me is that MacArthur was getting, even though he was sending false messages, he was also getting false messages back. It was, help is on its way. Don't worry, we're shipping out now. Soon you will have aid. Not true. Not true at all. And then there was a discussion, who shall have command of that region? Shall it be the Americans? Shall it be the British? And they finally worked it out. And they said, let's let the American command take that area. And so now these two gentlemen have talked for 90 minutes about the status of the world. I want you to really think about it for a second. They're in there, and Roosevelt is smoking his cigarettes with his fine cigarette holder and filter. Winston Churchill is smoking his cigars. By the way, they will send him 8,000 cigars while he's there. Churchill is drinking his brandy. Roosevelt is trying to stay even with him. And the fate of the free world is on their shoulders. It doesn't matter what they were doing or what their habits were. They were formulating plans and strategy. As their session ended at about 2 o'clock in the morning, Churchill got up and said, don't call your waiter. Don't call your butler. I'll wheel you to the lift. And there it was, a moment in American history. The Prime Minister of Great Britain wheeling the American president to a lift so he could go to bed. Churchill retired to the Rose Room, took two sleeping pills, and slept like a baby. The 23rd of December. Yes, did you have a good rest, Mr. President? Well, Winston Churchill had got a hold of the head waiter, or I should say the head usher. His name was Alonzo Field. And he told Alonzo Field, these are things that must happen if I'm going to remain your friend while I'm here. I don't expect any noise outside the Rose Room at any time because I sleep late in the morning. I expect the thimble of sherry beside my bed in the morning on my desk. As the morning progresses, I would like to have the finest scotch and soda that you have. I will lunch late and then take a nap. And then make sure you have at least the finest champagne and 80-year-old brandy at my disposal after my second nap. And then I will settle down to business. Oh my goodness. Well, they hold their first press conference. It's interesting looking at the first press conference because it's the only time they do a joint press conference. Because you know what? as well as they liked each other, they didn't want to have the limelight stolen from them. When Churchill was talking, Roosevelt looked kind of glum this way. And when Roosevelt was talking, Churchill looked the other way. They gave the information that they had talked about in a very succinct way. They also let it be known that censorship was there, and what was to be said had to be censored all the time. And so it was. They worked that out. And then on the 23rd, it was agreed that they would both give a Christmas message tomorrow to the American people on Christmas Eve. And so, with the press conference behind them, with instructions delivered to the White House staff by Winston Churchill, so the journey was on its way. Of course, another night of meeting, another night of eating and drinking. Well, the 24th arrived. And on the 24th, in the morning, Winston Churchill was preoccupied with what he was going to do. And if you were to take a close look at the White House, you would find him kind of in a grumpy mood because he was trying to think through in some of the talks he was going to have to give, and he needed the time. It was a sad time. There was no other way to call it. As hard as you try to be cheery, and Franklin Roosevelt really tried, he would have what he called an early cocktail hour, called a children's hour, where he would sit with some of his people and mix drinks and try to be jovial, but it wasn't there. You cannot manufacture it. And finally, he just said, "I think tonight, Eleanor, we will not read the Christmas story." She fully agreed. They always had done that. That had been tradition. "We will light the tree. We will do that. But we can't hang the stockings because our family's not here." They hung up one sock, and it was Fella, their dog, with some chewable bones in it. And that was it. You see, their four sons were someplace out there, one in the Marines, two in the Navy, and one in the Army. Winston Churchill's daughters had volunteered for the RAF, and they were ground observers and intelligent people, ciphering intelligence. Churchill missed his wife, Clementine. And so it was a tough struggle for them. And then Eleanor teared up. She thought about her good friend, Missy Lehan, who had been Franklin Delano Roosevelt's inseparable compatriot and partner, who had suffered a terrible stroke in the summer of 41, was still rehabilitating down in Warm Springs. She said to Franklin, "Will you call her?" And he said, "I can't," and he didn't. He could do that. He could distance himself. He could put it off if he didn't want to do it. And then he thought about his mother, who had died in September, and what she had meant to him. Well, it came time, and they went out in front of the White House. The tree was lit. Roosevelt said a few words, and Winston Churchill spoke to the American people. I'll come back to that. Not now. Christmas Eve went, they retired early, believe it or not. The next day at Christmas, still solemn, tried to cheer each other up, and they went to church. They went to the Foundry Church over in Virginia, the Foundry Methodist Church, the church that George Washington had worshiped in. It was there, believe it or not, that Winston Churchill sang Silent Night for the first time. So he said, in little town of Bethlehem, hard to believe. Came back for a nice dinner on gold plates from the Cleveland administration. and Churchill begged out to retire early to rest. He was tired, believe it or not. He always said this about rest. He said, if you can sit rather than stand, then sit. And if you can lay down rather than sit, lay down. And that's what he wanted to do. So Christmas Day passed. The next day on the 26th, he was to speak before both houses of Congress. He had worked on his speech most of the night, believe it or not, off and on. He would formulate his own words, craft his own sayings and quotes, and then he would go before both houses of Congress to deliver his talk. To reassure the leaders of our nation that he was supporting them and knew that they were supporting him. And so he did. He went before Congress and he gave his talk. He talked about his ancestry. He talked about that his mother had been born here. And he talked about this one of the greatest moments of his life to speak before the Congress of the United States. Did he ever think he would have the opportunity? And if he said it's one of the greatest moments, he says, you know, I haven't had an uneventful life, so this does mean something. And then he did a little chronology with the events in Europe and with the Japanese. And then he got to a point where he said, and to think that the Japanese attacked you at Pearl Harbor. And then he roared, who do they think they are? Who do these people think we are? How dare they do such a thing? They will pay a terrible price forever. And for 7 minutes, a standing ovation and a roar from the Congress of the United States. Winston Churchill at his best. At his best. And so, he will go back, be greeted by the Roosevelts, and he will say to Franklin Roosevelt, I hit it at all angles, didn't I? Very proud of himself, but he has to do something else. He has to start working on another speech. Or he's going to leave our country and he's going to go to Ottawa and speak before the Canadian Parliament. He has a day to get ready to go again. That evening, he goes to close his window. And he strained himself. And he felt pain in his chest. It shot down, according to him, his left arm. And he grew shortness of breath. He was suffering a cardiac event. Immediately called his personal physician, Sir Charles Wilson. Sir Charles Wilson examined him and said, I think if you just take it easy, rest, go to bed early, don't worry about your speech, I think you'll be all right and I'll monitor you for the whole night. And so he did. The next morning on the 27th, he felt a little funny, but he said, I think I'm all right. So he, without disclosing this to people, they boarded the train and they headed to Ottawa. All the way to Ottawa, Churchill kept feeling his pulse. Finally, upon arrival in Ottawa, the doctor said, damn it, Churchill, leave your pulse alone. You're going to live and don't worry about it. And so he did. And then the next day, he addressed the Canadian Parliament. And he made a speech about how he had been told how hopeless England was during the 1940s with the constant bombardment of the Luftwaffe. He was told on how many ministers from various countries had told him, "You'll never make it through. You will succumb. It's time that you gave up to the Nazis and called it a day." And then one of the foreign ministers from France said, "You know, Churchill, they will wring your neck like a chicken." And he closed off his speech to the Canadian Parliament was, "Some neck, some chicken." And there he was at his best. His heart started feeling immediately better. He spends another day there and he comes back on the 31st. Well, back in Washington, oh, there's been a reprieve. Eleanor Roosevelt is ecstatic. When she saw that train pull out for Canada, she was jubilant. "Good God, now my husband can get a night's rest. Finally, he can go to sleep at time." That night, he went to bed at 7:30. And she said to him in a little private meeting, "Franklin, you know that you're drinking too much. You don't have to do what he does. You're always doing what somebody else does. And your favorite sayings all the time is, yes, yes, you know, you're right, Henry. Yes, yes, you're right, Morgan. Yes, yes, you're right, Grace." He said, "You can't say that because sometimes he's not right. Let's face it, he's a colonialist. He's an imperialist. They have different aims in this country. Don't say he's right all the time." He looks at her and he says, "Well, Eleanor, as far as the drinking is concerned, it's your side of the family that has the problem." He was right. Not should have been said. And he said, "As far as the yes, yes, and that, and you're right, Eleanor, you're right, yes, yes." And that was it. But anyway, he had a night's rest, and thank goodness, because the next day was the New Year's. And en route, the Winston Churchill was able to celebrate aboard his train coming across the border to toast everybody and arrival back in this country on New Year's Day. Just to summarize some, think about what I have been talking about. Think about what was going on 79 years ago this month. What we are going through now and what they went through then. And think about the leadership that was there. You may have had problems with it, as Eleanor did, and the yes, yes, and the drinking, and as people did with the imperialist sport, but these two men were able to forge a relationship that's incredible. Both of them complimented each other on how intelligent they were on world affairs and on military matters. The thing that bothered some people, though, it seemed as if they were too fond of war. Their best moments were when they were in each other's map room, mapping out what was going on throughout the world. They had these little pens up there. One was shaped like a cigar that represented Great Britain. The other one was shaded like a cigarette holder, and that represented the United States. And the other one was a pipe that represented Stalin and the Soviet Union. Martha Gellhorn, who paid a visit to the White House at that time, the famous writer, the wife of Hemingway, said, "You know, I'd never seen two boys that enjoyed war so much as those two do." But whatever they did, whatever they sought out to do, was going to benefit in the long run the world that we faced in those days. The next day, sure enough, Eleanor said, "It's time that we went over to Alexandra and went to the Christ Church and celebrated our New Year's in church." And they listened to her. So with a small entourage, they went over to Christ Church and sat in the very church that George Washington had sat in before. And I've always thought about that. George Washington didn't have a particular like for Great Britain. And then they decided to go lay a wreath at the tomb down at Mount Vernon of George Washington. En route, it happened all over again. Yes, 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 Winston. Yes, I see what you mean. Yes. Eleanor hit the roof. She bit her tongue. Upon getting out of the car, she went over. She said, "May I speak with you? You know, just because my husband says yes, yes, it doesn't mean he agrees with you." Churchill didn't say anything. He said, "I want you to know not everything he agrees on, even though he's not saying it to you." Churchill had this philosophy: women do not need to be involved in these type of things. He didn't expect women to be involved. And now it was being reinforced, unfortunately, by Eleanor Roosevelt. Years later, when they met, long after the president had died, he said, "You didn't like me then, did you?" She said, "No, I wasn't fond of you at all. I did not like you then. I learned how to like you." And so, at the end of that day, it was agreed upon that Churchill would be on his way shortly back to England, and a whole new year would be starting. A whole new year, 42. The year of the rise of Eisenhower out of Washington. He was on the planning board for General Marshall, a colonel who will gain a star and become the head of the American Army and Armed Forces in Europe. Churchill wrote a note back to Roosevelt upon arrival on the 21st of January. And in the note, he said, "Isn't it good that we share this decade together? Isn't it good?" Now, I'm going to read to you Churchill's message, Christmas Eve, 79 years ago. "Almost the whole world is locked in deadly struggle, and with the most terrible weapons which science can devise, the nation advance upon each other. Here in the midst of war, raging and soaring over all the lands and seas, creeping nearer to our hearts and our homes, here amid the tumult, we have tonight the peace of the spirit in each cottage home and in each generous heart. There we may cast aside for this night at least the cares and dangers which beset us, and make our children an evening of happiness in the world of storm. Here then, for one night only, each home throughout the English-speaking world should be a bright island of happiness and peace." Let the children have the night of fun and laughter. Let the gifts of Father Christmas delight their play. Let us grown-ups share to the full in their unstinted pleasures before we turn again to the stern task in the formidable years that lie before us. Resolve that by our sacrifice and daring, that these same children shall not be robbed of their inheritance or denied their right to live in a free and decent world. And so, in God's mercy, a happy Merry Christmas to all." Thank you.
Wow, that's that was something. Absolutely. So a couple of things I want to mention, if I could. First of all, thank you, Jerry. That was a very inspiring and enthralling talk. And second of all, I know that there are a couple of people who have had trouble with the audio, which is beyond our control, obviously. It's up to each person receiving this, the presentation. But we will have this presentation on the Historical Society website within, I'm going to say a week or so. That's going to be up to Beverly because she does that that transferal. And while I'm talking about the Historical Society and the website, let me also please mention that you can find all of your holiday wishes and wants available, all sorts of Shabig-oriented gifts and books and such on the Historical Society website. And with that, what I'd like to do is open the floor to any questions, comments that by the way, I think we set a record. We have 41 people, again, more than 41 people, 41 screens tuning in, which is a record for this series. I think it's terrific. So if anybody has a question, by all means, let's hear it. Just down at the bottom of your screen, if you move your mouse down to the bottom of the screen, you can hit the raise hand. And I will see you and allow you to speak. Anybody with any questions or comments?
I have a raised hand.
I'm amazed that this is such a silent group. Usually everybody's talking at once.
Well, there's no raised hand at the bottom, David.
At least not on ours.
Really?
Yeah.
No kidding. Well, all right then. I haven't seen that before.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah. Okay, so
I just unmuted myself.
Yeah, let's just have a free for all. Whoever wants to speak, go ahead and speak, and we'll take it from there. Unmute yourself and speak up.
I was just curious if you could have had Jerry on a full screen. So watch everyone else, but just Jerry.
Right. The full screen is an option that's available to each individual participant.
Oh.
and if I had known that was going to be a problem, I would have mentioned it right off the bat. If you go up to the upper right-hand corner, you'll see speaker view, yep. Or if you click on it, you'll see gallery view.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know. As I say, I wished I'd thought of that. Usually in these presentations, our presenter has run a PowerPoint presentation, so everybody sees the same shared screen. And Jerry's talk tonight was a little bit different, and I hadn't anticipated that as a problem. I apologize.
No problem. Thank you.
Anybody else? Please just jump in since I can't see raised hands tonight.
Hi, Jerry. This is Eric and Christina and Sophie, and just wanted to let you know how much we enjoyed that.
We loved it. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Christina.
Jerry, it's Gretchen Tonks. I have to say that I am somebody who has read everything I can get my hands on about Winston Churchill, as well as Roosevelt and their relationship. And you just did a wonderful job of bringing to life sort of something that gets written about, but doesn't necessarily have life to it. And I thank you for that. It was terrific. So my congratulations.
Thanks so much. That means a lot.
And I hope that anybody else who has a comment can see down at the bottom of their screen, the lower left hand, where they can unmute themselves, I hope. Because I see a lot of muted icons here, and I hope nobody is just muting themselves and not allowing themselves to talk.
Jerry, Jerry and David, I see several of Jerry's former students on here. I would love to have them do a critique.
Yeah, the tables have turned. Huh?
I'm Chrissy Burr, Mr. Wild.
I was just going to call you out, Chrissy.
And it was so nice because Clarissa Mahalik actually let me know that you were going to be on, and it was just so nice because I felt like I was back in your eighth grade social studies class. And I don't know if you remember when you had to teach ELA to us with reading. And one of my best memories is when you threw the book I Am the Cheese across the blackboard.
Will you not talk about that right now,
please? But Chrissy and I have spent the last few years enjoying our national parks and history and collecting our passports, and we just were texting, we went to Mount Vernon. So, we've thought of you along the way with our history lessons. So thank you for inspiring a love of history.
And great talk.
I was late. Chrissy reminded me to tune in, so I can't critique.
Jerry, I have a question. I'm Barbara Merrill. I'm married to a Roosevelt scholar who was on a planning board meeting for most of your talk tonight, but was able to tune in near the end. What a wonderful storyteller you are. I wanted to share my little Roosevelt Christmas ornament. I've got Eleanor as well, but they got separated, and Eleanor is at our home in Virginia, not here on the island with us. But you said something earlier that I wasn't sure if I heard you correctly. When you first mentioned, I thought you first mentioned Churchill visiting, did you say Foundry Church in Virginia? But then later you mentioned Christ Church. Did he go to two different churches?
That there's the Foundry Church, I think it's in Virginia. I know the Christ Church is in Alexandria, Virginia.
No, Foundry's in D.C.
Okay, Foundry's in D.C. That's where I got. Okay, yes, Foundry's in D.C. The Christ Church is in Alexandria. The Foundry was on Christmas Day, and the Christ Church was on New Year's Day.
Thank you. I work just a couple blocks down from Christchurch, so I didn't know that about Foundry Church. I'm going to go look that up. Thank you so much. It's been really interesting.
Clarified that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, this is Bunny and Peter Wiles, your dear brother, just left the room for a moment. But yes, it was really great to see you. And I have some articles on Eleanor Roosevelt that were in our Brattleboro Reformer and her connections to Brattleboro. I just haven't gotten them in the mail as yet, but they'll be forthcoming.
Bunny is so good in getting me great articles out of Brattleboro. It's a wonderful connection. Thank you, Bunny. I'm so glad you joined. Thank you.
Jerry, could you lean in a little bit closer to the microphone?
Yes, I can.
Thank you.
All right.
Also wanted to chime in and say thank you for the talk tonight. I really appreciate the details. So it just makes them sound more like real people when you hear the stories about them working together in the map room with the different pins, you know, those kinds of things make it all seem much more real. So yeah, I was thinking about, you know, sitting in the annex listening to classes, and it brought back a lot of nice memories. So thank you.
May I ask who's speaking there?
Josh McHenry.
Oh, Josh. Okay. All right. Right there.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
So my question, Jerry, is did they have to restock the liquor closet after Churchill's visit?
Well, he was very particular about what he drank, of course. And I think that he stocked his own and so forth. But I left out a cute story, I'll tell it because I left it out and I thought you might want to know it because it kind of humanizes everything. When he was getting ready to give his first speech before Congress, Roosevelt was a little antsy and decided to drop into the Rose Room to see Winston Churchill, to see what he was up to. And when he dropped in, he looked and there was Winston Churchill just climbed out of the bathtub, stark naked. And supposedly he turned to Roosevelt and he said, "See, Mr. President, we have nothing to conceal from you." So we'll go on and we'll have a wonderful relation. That is one of the, I hope it's not a myth story. I hope it's true. I've read it a number of times, but that was just kind of a cute thing about their relationships and so forth.
Excellent. Well, any other questions, please chime in, anybody.
I have a question.
Yes.
So I'm curious about the logistics of leaving his country, sailing across the Atlantic, being gone for so long, having to sail back during all of this, you know, time of war and so much threat being on the ocean. That just seems like an unbelievable thing to be away from, you know, his country for so long and actually present himself to the, you know, sort of the rigors of crossing the Atlantic with the war and everything. Could you speak about that a little bit?
Well, of course, this, what he did was as secret as you could possibly get during the war. And I don't know the route that he took. And I have actually tried to research it, but I can never find out exactly what the route was. I think it was so secret, they don't even tell us today. And the idea was, they said, if you think it was a risk coming over, the real risk was going back, because the Germans knew he was over here and he would have to go back. And that I have not found. I only found out that he arrived back in England on the 21st and issued that communique to Franklin Roosevelt, it's good to be in the same decade as you. So I wished I could give you more answers on that part, but I don't have that. Think what happened, thinking he put himself out there on the high seas without, even if it was without war, how rough they were in December of that year. No, so, and he'll come back over more and more, by the way. He'll make quite a few trips over this country in his lifetime. They will see each other 9 times during the war, 9 times.
Anyone else?
I do. I found on YouTube the video of the meeting off of Newfoundland. It'll be fun to watch after your lovely talk. Thank you.
Thank you. Onward, Christian soldiers.
Right.
Next.
Quick question, Christina here. What's your favorite Winston Churchill quote?
Christina, are you sure that you're going to ask me that question? You should have called me before time, and then I would have been prepared for it. I just think probably the quote that I love better than anything else is the one about perseverance and the one about fear. Fear is an emotion, and courage is a thought. It's a thought outline. And he played upon that so much about the fear of the British people. You can get over the fear if you think clearly through it and use your intelligence. We can do well if we don't succumb to fear. And that probably is the quote that I thought had the more meat to it than anything of all of them.
Nice. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Go ahead, John. We're Mary.
Oh, no, we're all set. Sorry.
All right. Well, I have a question for you, Jerry. After the war, Churchill was no longer the head of England, the prime minister, but he came back a couple of years later. Can you fill me in on why he left and how he came back?
Well, he got voted out.
Yeah.
During the Potsdam Conference.
Why is that after such a stellar
He wore the British people out. He was a great wartime president. But they felt it was the time to have a change. And Clement Attlee, who happened to be in the running. And so when he went back home from Potsdam with Clement Attlee, they were shocked that he had been voted out. And it was pretty much, it's always been a great mystery, but it was, they needed a new voice. They needed new leadership during peacetime. And Eleanor Roosevelt said that too. She said it more than once. He is a great wartime leader, but I have my doubts about his peacetime leadership, because he is going to try to maintain a colonial empire the way it was before the war. So with all of these things falling in place, Truman woke up one day and there was Clement Attlee sitting there and not Churchill any longer. So he had to deal with at Potsdam to finish it up. He had to deal with Stalin and Clement Attlee. Then he makes a comeback. The British people have a softening of their hearts, the opening of their minds, and they bring him back in the 1950s to become prime minister again.
Interesting. Anyone else?
You know that he was quite an artist. You know that, don't you?
Oh, right. Oh, yeah.
Over 500 paintings, over 50 of them put in museums for display. And Picasso said, if he hadn't been prime minister and an artist, he would have made a good living.
How does he compare to George Bush as an artist?
Well, George Bush is good.
He is.
Very good at his portraits and so forth.
Any other questions, comments?
I'd just like to thank Jerry for coming up with a great topic. I left it up to him, and he's the kind of speaker you can just grab on the side of the road and say, hey, Jerry, will you come give a talk? And you're never disappointed when you have Jerry on the
I will show up anytime that you give me an 80-year-old brandy. I will be there with you. Well, thank all of you people tonight. It was very special for me. And Beverly was a wonderful helper. The poor woman, she's done 4 laps around this table and going crazy, but we pulled it off. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. I'm going to end this conference now, and I do appreciate everyone who tuned in tonight. And we'll be doing it again in a couple of weeks. So stay tuned. Watch Beverly's website and the various other methods of communication that we have. And we'll keep together this winter. Thank you so much,
David. The next one is Earl Shuttleworth. I think it's the 11th of January, and he's going to talk about architecture in the in Portland in the 18th and actually the 19th century. So
is that Bill's son?
Pardon me?
No.
Is Earl Shuttleworth. Is he related to Bill?
No.
It's spelled with an shuttle with an E instead of shuttle with a U.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
A Green State historian.
We all remember Bill Shuttleworth.
Yeah, he's a Green State historian, and Portland has so many wonderful examples of architecture from the 1800s. So this should be really good.
Good. Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, good night, everyone. And again, thanks Bye-bye. For tuning in.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa.
Whatever. Shop at the museum shop.
Yeah. Don't forget the museum shop. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.